Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
She was the quiet, steady, reliable daughter in a family of extroverted, flamboyant siblings, and then the devoted, loyal wife to one of America's most controversial founding fathers. Now a new book reveals her story, Eliza Hamilton, wife of Alexander Hamilton, and a founding mother in her own right. But the book's author, Tilar Matseo, says Eliza's tale was challenging to tell. Countless family letters and documents were burned, Matseo believes, by Eliza Hamilton herself to preserve Alexander's reputation. Today in The Exchange, the extraordinary life and times of Eliza Hamilton. And let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And author Tilar Matseo joins us from Maine. And Tilar, it's so good to talk to you. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you. So good to be with you today.
Well, we know about Martha Washington. I read a whole book about Abigail Adams. But you tell readers, Tilar, that your book is the first full-length biography of Eliza Hamilton. How surprised were you to discover that nobody else had done this?
Yeah, it is kind of amazing that no one had written her story before. But I think part of it, we can talk more about this, I don't think she wanted this story to be told in certain ways. So she made it difficult for you to do.
Well, her personality, she wasn't flashy, she wasn't outspoken, so kind of like you said, she was sort of a quiet, private person married to a very public man.
Exactly. She was an incredibly private person. She has this wonderful friendship with Martha Washington, and one of the things that they talk about in their letters to each other is sympathizing with how much privacy they lost because of being married into, obviously, married to very politically prominent men.
Well, and she burned all those letters, which we'll talk about in more detail. That's a big, big part of this. But how much were you, Tilar, inspired by the musical Hamilton to write this? I mean, Eliza Hamilton kind of emerged as a figure in that musical.
Yeah, so I got very, very lucky with the timing of this biography,
right?
Obviously.
Like, what came first?
Yeah, we'd been, so I write on women's biography and had been dancing around the subject of Eliza for quite a while. And the musical already existed by the time that I started working on the book, but the musical was not yet the musical, if you know what I mean. So in some ways, organically, those two things came together they developed on separate tracks. And it's interesting. I mean, the musical is a wonderful story about Alexander Hamilton, and obviously Eliza plays a big cameo role. But her story is really quite a bit different than the musical, I think.
Well, and your book really introduces us to this giant family, the Schuyler sisters, and how they influenced each other and how they influenced Eliza Hamilton. I just want to play a little bit from the musical, if I could, Tilar. This is, again, from the musical Hamilton, a song called The Schuyler Sisters, because that was Eliza's last name before she got married. And this is set in the early years with the three sisters, Angelica, Eliza, and Peggy, are getting caught up in revolutionary fever. Let's just hear a little bit. Again, that's from the musical Hamilton called The Schuyler Sisters. So there you hear them, Tilar, nervous about the coming Revolutionary War, excited about the sort of revolutionary fervor. How hard was it for the Schuyler family to decide which side to join? It doesn't seem like from your book that it was that hard for them to choose.
Yeah, I don't think there was any question in their mind. Their father, Philip Schuyler, had been involved in the French and Indian Wars, what we would call the French and Indian Wars before, and was already a significant military figure. But he was, and all of that family, were very, very clearly committed to the American Revolutionary cause from the beginning. And those girls did some – the sisters were amazing. There actually were more than three sisters. The three eldest ones are the ones that that song's about and that the musical highlights. And they also were engaged in some pretty amazing feats of resistance actively during the American Revolution. So it wasn't just that their father was committed to that cause, but I think all of the sisters saw themselves as active participants in the American Revolution, which I think is a pretty great story.
Well, there was a lot of spying going on back and forth, and the area where this family lived, sort of the Hudson Valley, Albany, and so forth, there were all sorts of intricacies. Nobody knew really who was a loyalist. There were the Native Americans. They kind of took sides. So what did these Schuyler sisters do toward that end?
Yeah, so one of the things that I thought was really interesting about the book was partly that how closely connected the family was with a number of the Native American, especially the Iroquois communities. We talk a little bit about how her dad pretty clearly had a Mohawk mistress who was a very, very political, important political figure, and probably was one of the women that he was running as a spy. So Philip Schuyler was a spy master, ran an important ring there, getting information back to Washington. And Angelica and Eliza, at least, kept their ears open and were actively passing local information to their father so that he could pass that along to the Americans. Because by the time the revolution really heats up, the Hudson River is one of the big battlegrounds.
Well, and talk a little bit more about that, if you could, Tilar. Again, being from New England, I'm very familiar with sort of the founding fathers and mothers of this region, but I'm less familiar with those wealthy Dutch landowners, the big movers and shakers in New York State. That's why in New York State, you know, a lot of stuff is named Van This and Van That. I mean, the Dutch really were the people who created that state and made it what it was. So just tell us a little bit more about that clan of wealthy colonists who helped make this revolution happen.
Right. So Eliza's family were absolutely members of the elite. They were the Dutch elite. And really the Dutch in upstate New York, in the Hudson River Valley before the revolution, were effectively feudal lords. And her mother and father were distantly related to each other. And they were both parts of some of the same very interconnected. I mean, all of these families intermarried with each other for generations. So the Livingtons, the Schuylers, the Van Courts, lots of large Van Courtlands, lots of families that intermarried. And they really owned these huge tracts of land that had both both enslaved labor and indentured labor. I think that's an important thing always to acknowledge, that they had these huge estates, and they basically functioned as feudal lords. They were the judges of these communities. So she came from that background. And these were very, very powerful and wealthy mercantile families, both British and Dutch. So part of what I always thought was interesting, and I hadn't totally understood, is, you know, why was it that the Dutch families threw in their lot so quickly with the American Revolution? And I think that's in part because they didn't have the same allegiances to British subjectivity.
Sure, they didn't feel that tie, that ancestral tie to England, and probably part of because of the wealth, too, right? Because they didn't want to share that wealth with the British crown.
They definitely did not want to share that wealth with the British crown. I mean, one of the things that I think is really important to remember is that especially in the upstate New York context, the American Revolution was not a peasant's revolt. It was very much a mercantile, an elite approach, a revolution, a resistance.
Wow. Okay, so here's Eliza Schuyler at this point, you know, in this sort of larger-than-life family, not just prominent in terms of wealth and land, but also a lot of this cast of characters is very, well, they're very outgoing, they're flirtatious, they like to party, they like to make raunchy jokes. And here's Eliza, she's kind of quiet and steady and, you know, would rather just hang out with Martha Washington and do her needlepoint. So how does she fit into this sort of boisterous family?
Yeah, she has an older sister, Angelica, who is very charming and vivacious and incredibly flirtatious. I think that does come across really well in the musical. And then she has a younger sister, Peggy, who was known at the time as the wild Schuyler girl. Peggy had a very difficult time getting married because her reputation as a kind of a fast young lady preceded her. And I think Eliza was the classic middle child. She was the peacemaker. She was the one who didn't rock the boat with her family. She was known as being incredibly good-natured. And over again in letters that people wrote about her during the time is that she just had a really sweet, easygoing temperament and was easy to be around and, you know, was funny and fun, but not raunchy. She did not have a raunchy sense of humor at all, and the other sisters did.
Well, so here she is, this sort of quiet, as you said, sweet, big-hearted person. She meets Alexander Hamilton. He's also a big personality. He's outgoing. He's very handsome. He likes flirting. He likes parties. You know, maybe he likes to gamble. I mean, why is he drawn to someone who, again, prefers the quiet of the fireplace?
Interestingly, they meet about at least a year before they ultimately begin their courtship, and it was not love at first sight. I mean, I think that's a really interesting part of that story. She had a crush pretty clearly in that previous period on another colonial Revolutionary War figure, a gentleman named Tench Teelman, who was a Southern gentleman. And so part of it was that she was really looking to get married because that was what that was the job of a young woman, to get married. So she'd met him the first time at her father's house when he was on his way to deliver a message to General Schuyler. And they didn't click the first time. And it's really the second time when they're at Morristown that following year that they meet and they connect in her aunt and uncle's parlor. And I think part of what had happened in that interim is that Eliza had been living with her sister and her brother-in-law, John Church, and she had seen what a kind of raucous marriage looked like and had decided she didn't want that. And Alexander, although he could have this very flirtatious and vivacious side, he also was, and this really becomes clear later in the letters in their marriage, he also was a little bit of a homebody. I mean, he was a domestic person who was looking to establish a home for himself. And I think because he was an orphan and hadn't had a home. So that was something that I think that they emotionally connected over, is this idea that we could sit by the fire and we could read poetry and we could sing ballads and there would be this retreat from this very busy public world. I think that was the beginning connection.
Well, and I definitely want to ask you about his image of sitting by the fire reading poetry, because that was also a source of tension. But I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at a brand new book called Eliza Hamilton, The Extraordinary Life and Times of the Wife of Alexander Hamilton. The author, Tilar Matseo, joins us. And you can join us, too. We'd love your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. What more do you want to know about Eliza Hamilton or the times that she lived in? And what do you think is misunderstood about America's founding fathers and their families, as we learn in this book? Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. So, Tilar, you just gave me the perfect segue to ask you about a constant source of tension in this very strong marriage. And that's the fact that Eliza Hamilton was kind of embarrassed about her ability to read and write. She wasn't very good at writing. Meanwhile, Alexander Hamilton is, you know, an amazing writer. And he kept urging her to be more like him in that regard. How come?
Yeah, my heart goes out to Eliza. Early in their marriage, in their courtship, they're in a long-distance relationship. Right, so they get engaged, and then Alexander has to go back to fight the American Revolution. And so for a long period at the beginning of their courtship, it's really in letters. And there are letters where Alexander can't help being just a little bit paternalistic and saying, you know, you're such a wonderful gal, and I'm really in love with you. But it would be really much better if you could improve your mind a little bit, so that we had really more interesting things to talk about by the fireplace. Oh. And Eliza gets this letter, and she doesn't respond. And there's it's quite a tender and funny moment. And Alexander begins writing these increasingly panicked messages. And he says, I'm sorry are you okay? Are you sick? Is that why you're not responding to my letters? Have I offended you? I'm really sorry. But what that does is that it sets up for Eliza what becomes really a lifelong insecurity for her, and sets up one of the fundamental tensions in their marriage. I mean, when Alexander gets upset with Eliza over the course of that marriage, it is consistently because she's not responding to his letters fast enough when they're away. And I think what he wanted was somebody more like her cousins, the Livingstons. So Sarah J. Livingston is one of her cousins. Angelica Church, her sister. These are women who are writing very witty and political letters to major figures. You know, so Angelica Church has an active correspondence with Thomas Jefferson talking about politics. And it's not that Eliza wasn't deeply passionate about politics. I think it's clear she was. It's that she didn't feel comfortable writing, in part because her spelling was really bad. So she felt embarrassed. And that was a huge tension for them in that marriage.
Well, and this is, as you said, Tilar, right from the beginning. And our friend Kevin Gardner read a little bit of one of the letters from Alexander Hamilton to Eliza. This is early on when they were courting. And in this letter, you can hear Alexander Hamilton's warmth and affection for his fiancée. But even at these very early stages of their relationship, you hear him urging Eliza to become more of a reader and a writer. So let's just hear a little bit. Again, this read by Kevin Gardner.
I entreat you, my charmer, not to neglect the charges I gave you, particularly that of taking care of yourself and that of employing all your leisure in reading. Nature has been very kind to you. Do not neglect to cultivate her gifts and enable yourself to make the distinguished figure in all respects to which you are entitled to aspire. You excel most of your sex in all the amiable qualities. Endeavor to excel them equally in the splendid ones. You can do it if you please, and I shall take pride in it. It will be a fund, too, to diversify our enjoyments and amusements and fill all our moments to advantage.
A letter from Alexander Hamilton to Eliza Schuyler at that point in August of 1780, while they were still courting. That letter read by Kevin Gardner. We're talking about a new book today in The Exchange called Eliza Hamilton, The Extraordinary Life and Times of the Wife of Alexander Hamilton. And you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Tilar, there you have it. You can do it if you please, he says. It'd be a fund, too, to diversify our enjoyments. So he thinks it'll make their life more interesting. But it's kind of insulting, at least to my modern ears. Like, he's engaged to her. Why can't he just accept her for who she is?
I know. It's not the love letter you want to get
no.
from a fiancé that
improve
you
yourself.
Yeah. No, I think she did. I mean, I think she found it hurtful, but I think more importantly, she believed that it was her fault, right? She hadn't been well educated. Women weren't well educated. And she was less bookish than either, well, certainly less bookish than Angelica, who was, you know, a woman who's very, very fluent, not only in other languages, but fluent in the language of courtesy and politics. And that just wasn't Eliza. The things that Eliza loved were she loved riding horses. She was a very fine horsewoman. And consistently, when she got stressed out, what she wanted to do was go ride a horse really fast. And she was an incredibly brave and adventurous woman who did speak pretty clearly some Mohawk. Who was very interested in, and willing to travel through the wilderness for several days. I mean, she was a frontier girl. And in many ways, I think that there was a kind of mismatch, just only in that sense, because as you say, it was a really strong marriage. But there was a mismatch between this very active, physical, almost tomboy-like frontiers girl and a very heady and ethereal, intellectual Alexander Hamilton. And that was a strength that they played on, but early in that courtship, I think he sounds to me a little bit paternalistic. I always get mad a little bit at Alexander with those letters.
Well, and he complains about that throughout their whole marriage. And at some point, reading this book, I just thought, okay, could you give it up? She's not going to write you a lot of beautiful, flowery letters. So the other thread that continues throughout this, again, very strong and difficult marriage, given all that they went through, is Hamilton calling her his Roman wife, and she really takes that to heart. Now, who is the Roman wife, Tilar?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because it really goes to the heart of what she does with that advice about reading and writing, I think. So he says, you know, improve your mind. And her father has one of the two or three best law libraries probably in the colonies, but certainly in New York. And Alexander and at one point Burr early on both come to study in that law library. So she's living in a home with a very fine law library. And one of the classic texts of the period are a series of different texts valorizing the idea of the Roman wife. And the idea of the Roman wife was that she was a wife who demonstrated stoicism and sacrifice and deep, deep loyalty to her husband and her family, but she did it in the name of the Republic, right? So that the Roman wife was a standard in law texts, and it was a model for a Republican woman, and I use that with a lowercase r, not like Republican Democrat parties, but in the sense of the birth of the American Republic. So I think one of the books that she goes and reads to improve herself is this book about the Roman wife, in part because Alexander explicitly says to her, you know, I'm asking you to be a Roman wife and not an American wife. And what he means by that is, I'm asking you to have that kind of dedication and sacrifice to the Republic that we're going to build, and not like your sister, who, you know, he finds very, very charming and wonderful, not be a woman interested in fashion and wealth and in society.
It's interesting, though, because he's asking her to be a Roman wife towards the goal of building this new American Republic.
Yeah, I think she sees I think she really sees, especially as the idea of the Roman wife unfolds, I think she sees her loyalty and sacrifice as a deeply political act in support of the American Republic.
How hard a story was this to tell, given that there's so little documentation of what Eliza said in her own voice? I mean, we'll get to the letters in a minute, Tilar, but at some point, did it feel weird to tell somebody else's story largely from the perspective of other people?
Yeah, that is a really challenging thing. I mean, one of the things that I found writing this book and researching this book is that Eliza herself wanted so much not to have her voice heard in certain contexts that you end up having to read the silences as well as what she says. And of course, it makes sense of the model of the Roman Stoic wife, right? That, you know, it is her actions that in some ways speak louder than the words.
That's hard to do, though, as a biographer. Maybe we'll talk about that after a short break, how you read into the silences. You don't want to get it wrong, but that's a tough one. We will pick up on that thread after a short break, and then we'll talk about how Alexander Hamilton's appointment as the first Treasury Secretary affects Eliza Hamilton. The story really takes off from there. So we'll pick up in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Hey there, it's Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A on NHPR. And as a fan of the show, I wanted to let you know that we are coming to New Hampshire, and you can be part of the conversation. Join me for an evening of fantastic discussion about issues that matter to you and to the Granite State. Join us on Thursday, October 18th at the Capital Center for the Arts in Concord. You can get your tickets right now at ccanh.com. See you then.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, author Tilar Matseo on her new biography of Eliza Hamilton, the first book ever written on this subject. Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome. What else do you want to know about Eliza Hamilton or her husband or just the times that she lived in? What do you think people need to better understand about our founding fathers and their families, including their wives? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can give us a call, too, 1-800-892-6477. So, Tilar, let's fast forward a little bit. And how did Alexander Hamilton's appointment as the first Treasury Secretary affect Eliza Hamilton? And again, you described earlier, she has this desire to have a quiet domestic life. Being the wife of Alexander Hamilton, first Treasury Secretary, is not a recipe for a quiet domestic life.
No. He keeps promising her that he's going to be done with politics and done with their having to live apart. And he keeps breaking that promise to her over and over again. And she understands. I mean, she understands why it is that he needs to work with the Washington administration and supports that. But what she really wanted more than anything was for them to have a family and live in a rural estate. And, you know, she'd been raised to be an estate manager. I mean, that was really what was what she had imagined her future being. And instead, she finds herself married to one of the brilliant stars of the early national period. And I've totally forgotten your question.
Well, it doesn't give her. No, you explained it. It doesn't give her the life that she dreamed of with this man that she deeply loves. And you're right. There's a lot of moving about due to his public career. They're in Albany. They're in New York City. They're in Philadelphia. Lots of time apart, as you said. And some of it's due to work and extended family reasons. Some of it, though, and I just thought this was an important reminder in your book, Tilar, some of it is for health reasons, because American cities back in those days were, you know, petri dishes for all sorts of terrible illnesses. So just remind us of that.
Yeah, yellow fever in particular was an epidemic in the period. So New York City and Philadelphia were both considered extremely dangerous places, and especially in the warmer months. And the mortality rate for children was also just phenomenally high. And one of the things that they immediately did was begin to have a family after they were married, and she had numerous children. And she was extremely lucky in that she did not lose children as babies. But all of her sisters and everybody else that she knew, including her mother, routinely buried infants. It was about a 40% infant mortality rate.
Wow.
And that was in part, can you imagine? And she was incredibly dedicated as a parent. In fact, so was Alexander. Despite his very high-flying status, some of the most wonderful letters between them are letters where he talks about the children, and he was a very, very dedicated father. So they took seriously being parents, and that was one of the deep concerns. So in the summers, she would routinely, and Alexander pressed her, she would routinely go to upstate New York and the Hudson to spend the summers with her parents and the children in order to keep the children safe from those diseases in the summers.
Well, so death is a constant presence, and as you write, held terrors for Eliza and her sisters. Another terror for her, in particular, Tilar, that you write about, was debtor's prison. So what was that?
Yeah, so bankruptcy didn't exist in the way that we now think of it. You couldn't, if things all went sideways, you couldn't declare bankruptcy and have your debts discharged. That happened really in the beginning of the 19th century, late 18th century. But in the period that she and Alexander Hamilton are first married, that is not the case, that you would go instead to prison, often for quite small debts, things that would be maybe the equivalent today of $100. And she once had that very famous portrait of her done in prison, because she agreed to go and sit for the portrait in prison in order to help the artist buy his freedom, right, to get escape from debtor's prison. So she saw firsthand what that looked like. And that means that later on, when Alexander is in the position of treasury, and they are living on a relatively modest income, and at that point, her father is financially strapped in a very significant way, and her brother Rensselaer is a gambler who her father has had to save from prison. And Angelica's husband, John Church, is a rake and a cad and a bounder of the first order. There's no getting around that. He's a consummate financial gambler. At that point, Alexander is really, he's right on the edge. I mean, he's in Treasury, right? He's making these decisions, and there's a stock market bubble that's going crazy. And she is incredibly worried about what it would mean, not only for her and Alexander, but what it would mean for anybody in her family to end up in debtor's prison. That is her great fear, is debtor's prison. And some of her cousins have husbands who do end up in prison and die there.
Wow. And back in the day, I think you write this, Tilar, that, you know, jailers would feed regular prisoners, but people who were there for debt reasons had to rely on family and friends to come feed them. Is that right?
That's right. One of Alexander Hamilton's early flames was a young lady named Cornelia Lott, right? During that winter in 1780 in Morristown, he had been courting Cornelia Lott, and Cornelia Lott's father was embezzling money and ended up in debtor's prison. And Eliza felt huge sympathy for Cornelia, because not only could Cornelia not ultimately get married because nobody wanted to marry somebody's daughter if their father had been, you know, was an embezzler and a financial criminal, but Cornelia and her sister were left with with no income and no ability to get a job as young women, having to find a way to raise the money to bring their father food in prison and firewood and coal. I mean, things to keep him warm as well.
You know, finance and the fear of debt, as you're alluding to, Tilar, play an enormous role in this family's story, which kind of makes sense given that Alexander Hamilton was the first Treasury Secretary, but also given the background of a lot of men in this family who did sort of play fast and loose with stock markets and debt and so forth. And just judging from your book, Tilar, it seems Alexander Hamilton did make decisions as Treasury Secretary that benefited his family. A quote from your book right here: more than one representative said to colleagues in a low voice that the Secretary of Treasury was trying to ram through a financial program structured to benefit Eliza's powerful relations and other members of the colonial aristocracy. So without going into too much financial detail, what sorts of things did he do? Were some of those suspicions and low murmured rumors true?
Yeah, I mean, remember the idea of insider trading didn't exist then, right? So we're talking about a moment in time when the American Republic is really defining itself. Hamilton is hugely involved with setting up our financial system. But he certainly did have conflicts of interest. So, for example, the easiest example is that John Church, Angelica's husband, who was actively engaging in trading stocks and in land speculation, Alexander, while he was in Treasury, continued to act as an attorney for John Church, buying and selling stocks that he himself had control, obviously, ultimately over.
Which seems amazing now, right?
That seems astonishing now, yes.
So some of these accusations were probably true, that he was sort of manipulating things to benefit his family.
I think he probably, him in his own mind, did not see it that way, but yes. Right. I think one of the things I say at one point in the book is that Eliza and her family, I mean, they had the position before the revolution of effectively feudal lords. I don't think it ever really occurred to them that they shouldn't benefit from the financial systems that were being developed. I mean,
interesting.
I think there was a blind spot. Yeah.
Okay. They just thought, we are the aristocracy. We helped run this revolution, we helped this country get started, and so now we will reap some of the benefits of that. It doesn't occur to them that, you know, maybe that's not quite on the up and up. I want to remind our listeners that you can join us with your questions and comments. Our number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. We'd love your questions and comments about some of the stories we're hearing about one of America's lesser-known founding mothers, Eliza Hamilton. And we're talking about a brand new book called Eliza Hamilton, The Extraordinary Life and Times of the Wife of Alexander Hamilton. The author, Tilar Matseo, is with us. And you can join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Tilar, as we talk about, you know, some of the financial questionable activities conducted by this family, and especially Treasury Secretary Hamilton, we need to get into what is called the Reynolds Affair. And people can read the book, okay, to get all the detail. But just how does this questionable financial approach by this family lead to the Reynolds affair?
Right. So James Reynolds is one of the things I found in the course of the research. James Reynolds had some connections earlier to Hamilton, both because of his service during the American Revolution, and he had been connected to one of John Church's business partners.
That's Hamilton's brother-in-law. Yeah,
without, Hamilton's brother-in-law.
Without Angelica's, getting into too much of the family tree.
That's right. Yep, yeah. So Angelica's husband. So what happens is how to cut through to it. Hamilton's version of the story is that he was seen going over to the Reynolds house, and they were seen to be exchanging envelopes and money, and that this evidence existed. And this was something that members of Congress discovered. Members of Congress who were opposed to him politically and opposed to the Washington administration. And those senators begin asking some questions, saying, we have a source that tells us that you're engaged in speculation and in effectively insider trading. And they wanted him removed, and they were wanting to bring down the Washington administration.
So he concocts Hamilton, this big story to cover it up.
And that, well, yes. So he says, what he says is, oh, no, I wasn't over exchanging money to engage in financial speculation with James Reynolds. I've been having an affair with his wife, Mariah, and they've been blackmailing me, and I've been paying the blackmail. And at this point, they're doing a congressional inquiry into this. The senators come to the home, and they say, we don't really believe your story. That doesn't make any sense. And he says, well, I've got these letters. I have love letters from Mariah Reynolds. I'll show them to you if you come back this evening. And the senators and the public press, this was all over the newspapers, the story was that Hamilton was accused of having forged those letters as a cover-up in collusion with James Reynolds for this insider trading. Hamilton decides to prove the lie, right? He decides that, because he never produces the actual love letters that were the forged love letters, but instead he decides to publish them in a pamphlet where he acknowledges to the world that he has cheated on Eliza.
Which is amazing to think about it, that he publicly publishes this thing that says, yes, I cheated on my wife, and that that's better than admitting, you know, financial misdoings.
Exactly. It was like the singular most important act of self-harm by any early American politician.
Well,
because it wasn't believed, right? It still wasn't believed by members of Congress.
Well, let's hear a little bit again from actor Kevin Gardner reading from this pamphlet that you mentioned, Tilar. This is Hamilton's public apology published in a pamphlet, not in the newspapers, regarding his affair with Reynolds. Let's hear.
This confession is not made without a blush. I cannot be the apologist of any vice because the ardor of passion may have made it mine. I can never cease to condemn myself for the pang which it may inflict in a bosom eminently entitled to all my gratitude, fidelity, and love. But that bosom will approve that, even at so great an expense, I should effectually wipe away a more serious stain from a name which it cherishes with no less elevation than tenderness. The public, too, will, I trust, excuse the confession. The necessity of it to my defense against a more heinous charge could alone have extorted me so painful an indecorum.
Again, that's a bit from Alexander Hamilton's public apology regarding an affair that he may or may not have had, according to our guest today. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So we don't know, Tilar, how Eliza Hamilton reacted to that.
Well,
I mean, how embarrassing, first of all,
yeah,
to have
how
this pamphlet published.
Right. We do know one part of how she reacted to it, because Hamilton was, again, out of town when this pamphlet is published. And John Church, Angelica's husband, goes, Hamilton writes to John and he says, will you go and check on Eliza? This pamphlet's just come out. He's in Philadelphia. And he says, will you go check on Eliza and see how she's doing, because this just hit the press. And John Church goes over and he does write a letter to Alexander Hamilton. And he says, I went in and Eliza had the pamphlet in her hand and she simply looked at me and she was very, very calm. And she said, it's all a lie. It's his political enemies and this is not true. He never cheated on me.
Well, in the musical Hamilton, in a song called Burn, the producers show Eliza's imagined response to the public apology from Hamilton about this Reynolds affair. And we'll hear her singing. We'll never really know what her response was because she did burn the letters. Let's hear.
The world has no place in our bed. They don't get to know what I said. I'm burning the memories, burning the letters that might have redeemed you. You forfeit all rights to my heart. You forfeit the place in our bed. You sleep in your office instead with only the memories of when you were mine.
A song from the musical Hamilton, again called Burn. So there she says it. They don't get to know what I said. Frustrating for you, Tilar, as Eliza Hamilton's biographer.
Yeah. I want to say something about that. So about
Please,
the letters,
yeah.
Right? So it is true that she burns pretty clearly. I mean, somebody burns, and Eliza was the last person to have them. So we're going to assume that it was Eliza burns her love letters to Alexander Hamilton. She doesn't burn her letters to her sisters, right, or other family members, and she doesn't burn his letters to her. So the only piece that's missing of that puzzle are her love letters to Alexander Hamilton, that one side of that, of the correspondence of the marriage. But you may have remember that Sotheby's had a big auction of private Hamilton papers. And I was able to see that collection before it went up on auction. And there are lots and lots of letters about, you know, the sisters talking about recipes and, you know, dress patterns and are you going to go see mom and dad? And, you know, here's a bushel of apples, right? There's lots and lots of those letters. But what I think is the case is that I don't think that the letters she burned, I don't think she burned the letters that could have redeemed him. I think she burned the letters to protect him. So the, you know, there's two versions, right? And there's not really any way to know for certain because there's only two people who know if Alexander Hamilton and Mariah Reynolds had an affair, right? The two of them. Mariah Reynolds insisted that she never had the affair and was willing to testify to Congress on that. Alexander Hamilton said they did. And so the conventional story, right, the story that's in the, and this is really, you know, a mainstream reading of Hamilton's life is to believe Hamilton. Hamilton says, I had the affair, and that has historically been accepted, that's the case. But in the 18th and 19th century, that was not what people believed. And that was also not as early as the 70s or 80s what mainstream scholarship believed. They believed that Hamilton had forged those letters.
And we won't ever really know unless all of a sudden these letters turn up and they weren't burned.
And Eliza clearly burned them. We know that they were in a packet marked with the initials JR, and that the last person who had that packet with the initials, with the letter JR, was Eliza Hamilton.
Well, coming up after a short break, Tilar, I'll ask you how this whole Reynolds affair leads to the duel between Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're talking with Tilar Matseo. She's author of a new biography of Eliza Hamilton. And let's hear from you, your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. So, Tilar, how does this whole Reynolds affair, you know, we talked about whether he really did have this affair with Mariah Reynolds or not, whether it was used as a cover-up for, you know, shadier financial activities. But how does this whole controversy lead to a duel between Aaron Burr and Alexander Hamilton, who, by the way, have never really liked each other?
Exactly. So what happens is after the, as I said before, the pamphlet that Hamilton publishes is seen as just an act of massive self-harm, right? He publishes this seen as very, very scandalous and indiscreet confession, and many people even still don't believe it, right? So he's taken a bad situation and managed to make it significantly worse. And I think it's important to remember that this was an incredibly partisan period, so that Burr and Hamilton are on opposite sides of a political divide, and this is a political moment that makes our political moment look like a reasonably nonpartisan moment, if you can imagine such a thing. So what happens is that Hamilton's reputation is ruined, and he has kids who are young men now and going to the university, and they have to live up to the humiliation of their father's scandal. And that leads ultimately to their eldest son, Philip, being in a duel and being killed in that duel.
Which I had not known, by the way, until I read this book. It's heartbreaking. Yeah. He's 17, I think.
It's awful, right? And Eliza's feeling about that, and I think Alexander's feeling about that, was that in some ways it was his decisions that had led to, and also their parenting. I mean, he was a wild child, and, you know, there are letters where Eliza keeps saying, I need help, Philip's out of control. And Alexander is, you know, kind of spoils his son a little bit. He sees him as a golden child. And so Philip dies, and I think Alexander feels responsible for that and feels that in some ways, you know, his decisions have led to the death of his son. And he also ends up blaming Burr and members of Burr's party for the death of Philip in certain indirect ways. So at that point, you know, when we talk about Alexander Hamilton's possible financial indiscretions, I think it's likely that Alexander Hamilton, you know, may have bought some stocks himself that he knew were going to go up. That's a possibility. I think more likely the financial indiscretion involved is one of appearances, and it has to do with him trying to protect Eliza's family, who are engaged in really probably inappropriate speculation.
Yeah, lots of gambling on that side of the family.
Lots of gambling on that. I think it was meant to protect the Schuyler family in lots of ways, and the and Angelica's husband in lots of ways. So then what happens is Alexander Burr ends up, who is also wildly speculating on things, he gets involved in a deal that has to do with water supply in New York. And Alexander finds out that he's been tricked in this negotiation into supporting something that he believes is going to be really harmful to the poor people of New York. And Alexander and Eliza were already deeply committed to, in part because of, you know, his background, deeply committed to the idea of addressing the needs of the poor and certain kinds of social injustice, right? She had already brought in orphan children that they were raising as members of their family. You know, they were very, very committed to this idea of a kind of level playing field, even though they have these blind spots about their own privilege as members of the sort of, you know, colonial aristocracy.
So they're very excited to start this clean water project in New York, help reduce some of the disease in the city. Burr kind of tricks them. It's not what they think. So then the two men say, let's shoot it out. I mean, how does that happen?
Well, yes, exactly. So what happens is that Alexander Hamilton is at a dinner party in upstate New York, and he's running his mouth. And he is talking trash about Aaron Burr. And Aaron Burr, I mean, talk about somebody who really does have some significant some sexual indiscretions. Like, Aaron Burr, you know, is quite a player in the scene. And this ends up getting reported in the newspaper, and Burr is offended, challenges him, and Alexander Hamilton doesn't back down. And they ultimately go to that fateful duel. And Hamilton plans to throw away his shot, and Aaron Burr starts target practice.
Yeah. So it's heartbreaking, especially. And can I just say, it seems incredibly stupid now with modern eyes. I mean, his own son died in a duel. He has his family. He loves his wife. He loves his children. And he still does this. It's kind of maddening to look at this with modern eyes and say, couldn't you just let the insult sit, you know?
Well, and there's a wonderful journal by one of Eliza's cousins, a woman named Eliza Bleeker. It's in the New York Public Library, this journal. And she's, you know, and Eliza goes and visits her cousin regularly. And, you know, Hamilton's duel is recorded in this. And one of the things that her cousin says is that she talks about hearing about a duel and about how neither of the children were hurt. I mean, there was this view among the women of the time that this was just childish behavior. And Alexander, I think, had promised Eliza that he would not be in another duel because this was not his first duel.
Wow. Well, and there's this famous farewell love letter that Alexander Hamilton writes just before he takes off for this duel. A duel that, by the way, he had not told her about. So let's hear his last letter to Eliza Hamilton. Again, this is read by actor Kevin Gardner.
This letter, my very dear Eliza, will not be delivered to you unless I shall first have terminated my earthly career. To begin, as I humbly hope, from redeeming grace and divine mercy, a happy immortality. If it had been possible for me to have avoided the interview, my love for you and my precious children would have been alone a decisive motive. But it was not possible without sacrifices which would have rendered me unworthy of your esteem. I need not tell you of the pangs I feel from the idea of quitting you and exposing you to the anguish which I know you would feel. Nor could I dwell on the topic lest it should unman me. The consolations of religion, my beloved, can alone support you, and these you have a right to enjoy. Fly to the bosom of your God and be comforted. With my last idea, I shall cherish the sweet hope of meeting you in a better world. Adieu, best of wives and best of women. Embrace all my darling children for me. Ever yours, A.H.
Again, that's the farewell love letter by Alexander Hamilton to his wife, Eliza, just before his duel with Aaron Burr. Thanks to Kevin Gardner for reading that. And, you know, at this point, Tilar, I have listened to Kevin read that about 5 or 6 times because I'm so struck by all the language in there. If it had been possible to avoid the interview, meaning the duel, you know, of course I would have done so. I love you. I love the family. But it was not possible. Again, reflecting on it from a modern perspective, you think, of course it's possible. Why did Alexander Hamilton feel that this was necessary, given his deep abiding love for his wife and family?
Yeah, I think for him, he thought of it as a matter of honor, right? That his son Philip had died protecting the honor of his father. And I think part of it, is that Alexander knew the risk he was taking, and there was a little bit of a self, Alexander Hamilton had a little bit of a self-destructive streak, I think. And I think part of it is that he bore this immense guilt over the death of Philip. And I think part of him felt that it was a kind of ethical and moral commitment, not only to a notion of honor in the public sense, although that too, but to this notion of, you know, somehow in some convoluted way making it right with his kid. I think that was part of what was going through his mind. Because the night before the duel, which, as you say, he didn't tell Eliza about. There's a wonderful letter that one of his other sons wrote later, talking about how Alexander took all of the children out into the field by their house in the Grange in Harlem and lay with the children under the stars, looking at the stars while the sun came down, and convinced Eliza to come out with the baby. And the whole family lay there on the grass looking up at the heavens. And that was really, that was what he did. Right in the last days before that duel, and then he takes his son and sits down with the next eldest boy, and prays with him, and that's his idea of what you do to prepare for this duel, and I think it's hugely telling, right, that it has to do with especially his boys. And I think it was Philip that he was thinking about trying to make things right with when he went into it.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So right after he dies, Eliza is beside herself. She can't even go to his funeral. And boy, we could talk for another hour, Tilar, but what is it that helps her at least get up and get out of bed and continue on in the weeks after her husband's death?
So she has kids.
She has a lot of kids.
She's now a single mom. She has a lot of kids, some of whom are her own and some of whom are orphans that they've been raising. And, if we think about that, quote about Eliza and the best of wives and best of women. One of the things I talk about in the poem is that's a reference, a kind of rewriting of a ballad that they used to sing to each other when they were courting. And it goes back to that idea of the Roman wife. And I think Eliza felt that she had taken a hit for the team, that she had been, and I think Alexander recognized that she had been the Roman wife, that I think she probably knew the truth about the Reynolds affair and that there probably hadn't been one and that it was a cover-up. And she felt that the death of her son was part of the sacrifice she had made so that the Washington administration didn't fall. And in the end, she held to that. I think she held to the idea that she had been a stoic Roman wife, that she was the mother of Hamilton children, and that she had an obligation to raise them. And she did become increasingly devoted to her faith as time went on. I think she did that in part because Alexander asked her to do it. She goes on and, you know, does, I mean, she lives another 50 years.
Which is amazing in those times.
In those times, yeah, she lives to be nearly 100. And she writes his biography because she's committed to setting the story straight. I think she clearly is the person who does burn the Reynolds letters, right? They're last in her possession. But she also does a series of other things that in her mind are commemorating this legacy that she sees that her family crafted. So she opens the first free school, public school in Harlem, in Hamilton Heights, and for the education of poor children and orphan children. And she also helps to co-found the first private orphanage in New York, an organization which not only did she help co-found, but she helped steward throughout the 19th century so that it exists today. Right, it's one thing to start a charitable organization, but it's another thing to stick with it long enough and to build it solidly enough that that Graham Wyndham in New York still exists today as her legacy.
Well, and I really, really want to thank you for being with us today, Tilar. Thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.